So good afternoon. I want to welcome all of you to the Caution Museum at the National Academy of Sciences. My name is Richard Bissell. I'm Executive Director of the Policy and Global Affairs Division here. And it's really a pleasure and an honor to have this event this afternoon as part of our commemoration, our contribution to the 40th anniversary celebration at EPA, and also to be able to launch, I think, what will be a very important study that we'll be conducting over the next 6 to 9 months for EPA. Without further ado, I want to simply ask a small group of distinguished speakers to present to you, and then we'll have time, hopefully, for some Q&A and discussion. First up, of course, is the President of the National Academy of Sciences, Ralph Cicerone, who needs no further introduction. He's well known to most of you, and he will make remarks on behalf of the Academy.
I have two quick impressions of this gathering already. It's a who's who. It's just great to see these faces here today. Administrator Jackson, thanks so much for being here. Hearing the sirens makes me think we're at our old building over on Constitution Avenue. It's just amazing how many sirens and processions go past there. But seriously, we hope the launch of an important undertaking that will help EPA think through its future on this amazingly important set of topics that we call sustainability. So we have here today with Administrator Jackson, Professor Bernie Goldstein, who will talk about launching this study incorporating sustainability in the United States Environmental Protection Agency. For some time, this word sustainability and the phrase sustainable development has rolled off of our tongues around the world, and it's a very compelling vision and need simultaneously, and yet it has resisted progress along many lines. Here at the Academy, we've tried and I think have had some success over the last 20 years now of supporting and indulging in sustainability-related work. Just as an example, we have one of the premier scientific journals in the world. It's called the Proceedings of the National Academy of Sciences. 5 years ago, we created what's called a separate section for papers every week on sustainability science. And it is absolutely breathtaking to see the scope of papers that are published there. Everything from manufacturing concepts to logistical calculations to biodiversity, environmental food issues, water, forestation and so forth, agriculture. So it's helping the community of researchers to focus and to realize that there is a very important and difficult, challenging scientific basis to this question of sustainability. We also published a book a few years ago called Our Common Journey that led us into a very far-ranging set of pursuits, and I think it also convinced us that this challenge of defining and operationalizing, if there's such a word, what sustainability means is very important. The George and Cynthia Mitchell Endowment for Sustainability Science has helped us and has also provided a focus for a number of federal agency projects which have come here on related issues. But the current study, which we're about to launch on behalf of EPA, we think could represent a pivotal view in how far sustainability science has come. And it could, we hope, become the type of very distinctive contribution that our National Research Council can provide. A committee in our science and sustainability sustainability science program will author a report which will go through our normal, very rigorous writing and peer review process for the Environmental Protection Agency, for the Office of Research and Development, to help define EPA's efforts to incorporate sustainability, the concepts thereof, into agency programs. This study will articulate an operational strategy that can then be used to support the goal of long-term sustainability, and we hope that the committee and the writers do come up with something which is immediately useful to EPA. That remains to be seen, of course. The committee's statement of work will focus on answering one overarching question: how can EPA adapt its practices and use a systems management approach to address complex sustainability challenges? The study will address questions including, or such questions as, what should be the operational framework for sustainability for EPA? How can the EPA decision-making process, rooted for more than two decades in the risk assessment, risk management paradigm, be integrated into this new sustainability framework? What scientific and analytical tools are needed to support the framework? What set of strategic metrics and indicators should EPA build to determine if sustainable approaches are or are not being employed successfully? Finally, which assessment techniques and accounting protocols should the agency adopt to inform ongoing efforts to improve agency sustainability practices and procedures? These are incredibly important questions. The notions that we have challenges in sustainability has not even been widely accepted yet by many people in this world, but as they become more aware of the issues, the questions that I just listed will become clearer and clearer as a challenge to the EPA. In addition, the committee will make recommendations to strengthen the agency's transdisciplinary sustainability science research program by answering questions like, what are the core questions for a sustainability science research program at EPA? What characteristics are indicative of a research program that addresses sustainability in the first place? We wrote a report in 1983, and I use the word we very immodestly because it was many other people, entitled Risk Assessment in the Federal Government, which Professor Goldstein calls the Red Book. Many of you do. This study, in a comparable way, will explore the relationships among science, policy, and innovation in an emerging field, in this case, sustainability science and technology. The committee will examine the role that EPA currently plays in reducing adverse environmental and human health impacts through risk management, regulation, voluntary program, and other non-regulatory programs. A central consideration will be how a government agency such as EPA can exhibit flexibility in support of a transition to sustainability, which is the way our Common Journey report phrased it 10 years ago, which by definition is a collective, adaptive, and somewhat uncertain endeavor. The committee will characterize emerging challenges for environmental protection, factoring in the need to address multiple environmental media and stressors, the role for interdisciplinary research, and the opportunities for innovative solutions. The committee's report will define for EPA an analytical framework that will then be scaled up under the sustainability linkages in the federal government initiative to help other federal agencies to examine the consequences, trade-offs, synergies, and operational benefits of sustainability-oriented programs. So we are very pleased to help and to attempt to advise EPA in this endeavor, and we look forward to working with Administrator Jackson, with Assistant Administrator Paul Anastas, and his staff in bridging the worlds of research and action, as you've done already in your career so far, Paul, to advance sustainability science. We have accepted the challenge from EPA to work quickly, and thoroughly, yes, and look forward to sharing a podium this summer, this coming summer, 2011, to release a report from a committee which is a very distinguished group, and let's make it happen. Thank you.
Thank you. The second person to speak today is Administrator Lisa Jackson, the Environmental Protection Agency. As we welcome her to the podium, I just want to say how grateful we are for the partnership that we have formed with this administration on a range of environmental issues, but particularly in bringing sustainability to the fore. And I think her leadership can be credited for making this happen. So let's welcome Administrator Jackson.
Well, thank you so much. Thank you, Dr. Bissell. It is an honor to be here. Let me say that again. It really is an honor to look out at this group of distinguished scientists and policymakers and practitioners and know there's such interest in our little announcement today. Paul, you were right. Let me begin, though, by thanking our host, Dr. Cicerone. We met a while ago to talk about ways we could work together, but this is truly visionary, and I can't tell you how excited I am that we could find a way to do this week, and I'll tell you all why in a second. And Bernie Goldstein, who used to be, way back when, one of EPA has been blessed with some really visionary and strong practitioners of science. And Bernie Goldstein, I think, when he was AA for the Office of Research and Development at EPA, led the way and in many ways was a template for the kind of work that we're doing today. He actually is a good friend of one of my dear mentors, Glenn Paulson, who was also my very first boss. Now, it would be wrong if I didn't actually give credit where credit is due. Paul Anastas, who currently leads our Office of Research and Development, is really responsible for pushing and pushing, even from Africa, to make sure that this event happened today and that it happened in a timely manner. And I have no doubt that he will continue the tradition of visionary leadership and practice of environmental protection and environmental development, which is part of the Office of Research and Development. I have to say hi to my general counsel who's here, Scott Fulton. But then I also have to embarrass someone, Dr. Marina Moses, who I just know as Marina. I cannot think, you know, of a better person who embodies what we're trying to do. I met Marina. We worked together for years at EPA in New York City. She worked on risk assessment. And I would always try to make sure Marina worked on the projects I worked on because she had a practical understanding of what was the Red Book. She was implementing the Red Book, its principles, every single day. And so now she's going to lead a project here to help make sure that we get your thoughts on how to move to the next step. And so I want to thank Marina for her leadership as well. And I know Peter Proust is here somewhere, and I got to say hi to him as well, just because. Now, I'm a scientist myself, so it's an honor to speak with you today. As you know, this week we are commemorating the 40th anniversary, I prefer to say birthday, of the Environmental Protection Agency. As part of marking the milestone, I visited the Aspen Institute just yesterday morning to discuss what they developed as 10 highlights of EPA's work from the last 40 years. I'd like to share them with you because it's kind of fun. There's some things you expect and some you don't expect on the list. Number one, removing lead from gasoline and from the air. Number two, removing the acid from rain. Number three, clearing secondhand smoke. Many people don't realize that it was the risk work on secondhand smoke that actually inspired most of the non-regulatory work and all the state laws on secondhand smoke and Frank Lautenberg's work on smoke on airplanes. All that came out of risk studies done by the EPA. Number four, vehicle efficiency and emissions controls. Not surprising. You know, the number of cars on the road in this country has probably doubled since EPA was formed. Don't quote me on that number. I'm just thinking about it as a scientist. That might not be right. But air emissions have gone down. That's because we've demanded cleaner and cleaner cars. That's the work of EPA in practice. Controlling toxic substances. Now I'm fond of saying we have a lot of work left to do. But still, part of EPA's mandate is to help the American people understand in a risk framework the regulation and the ability to regulate toxic substances to achieve an endpoint. I argue that we haven't quite gotten there yet, but part of it is that we need a new law to change what endpoint is acceptable in terms of our regulatory work. Banning the widespread use of DDT. Most people know that that came out of Rachel Carson's work and Silent Spring and a whole bunch of other things, but one of the first actions that Ruckel's House took, right, was banning DDT. Rethinking waste as materials. All the work that happens at the local levels, at schools. I was at a school in Atlanta just this morning around recycling, which we and our children now take for granted, started as a germ of an idea of how to think about managing waste. And that work happened at the policymakers at EPA. A clean environment for all, environmental justice. The idea that we are not finished with our job until every single American, regardless of income, regardless of race, regardless of where they live, knows that they too enjoy the bounty of clean air, clean water, and clean land. Number nine, cleaner water speaks for itself. 90% of Americans have access to drinking water that meets very strict national standards. Obviously, 90% isn't the goal. 100% is. But if we think about a Cuyahoga River that burned, we know we've come a long way on water quality. And finally, and certainly not the least, the Community Right to Know Act, the simple concept that every American has the right to know what is being emitted in his or her community. Very simple, very powerful. So much of what we talked about at the Aspen event centered on the role good science has played in making all of those advances and many more possible. It reinforced just how critical it is that we shift the conversation on environmental issues away from politics and back to science. If we rely on science, we will make decisions on clean air and water that are based on human health. It allows us to identify and articulate very clearly what it is we face and what it is we're trying to do. On issues like climate change and smog and toxic chemicals, the science can and should and must speak for itself. Good science moves us towards shared solutions, like the ones on the Aspen list, solutions that have literally made environmental history. The reverse is also true. Attacks on good science move us toward shared consequences. In recent weeks, we've heard a lot about plans to undermine the work that EPA does, particularly through questioning our science. These attacks might be targeted at EPA, but the impacts will be felt by the American people. Pollutants like mercury and smog and soot are neurotoxins and killers. They cause developmental problems and asthma in kids and heart attack and premature deaths in vulnerable adults. Refusing to deal with them is really consigning future generations to dirtier air, or dirtier water, or more health problems, as is the refusal to deal with climate change on the same grounds. Not too long ago, Representative Bob Inglis, an outgoing Republican from South Carolina and member of the House Energy and Environment Committee, had a warning to climate scientists that hearings before that committee would be difficult in the next Congress. However, his point was that scientists should welcome those hearings. He recommended that scientists come to those hearings not defensively, but gladly, got a smile, eager for the opportunity to make their case, to make our case on a critical issue, an issue that's critical to the world and to the American people. I agree with him, because in the end, these are not partisan issues. They're about our health. They're about our well-being, about our future. So I want to thank everyone here in advance for all you've done, for being a bulwark against some of the possible coming attacks. Thank you for standing, as always, as an independent verifier of the science that allows us to do our jobs. And thank you for helping us improve the way we operate, which I'll get to in just a moment. We've come a long way from the time when a look out the window revealed smog-filled skies, from the days when our rivers caught on fire. Because of EPA's efforts over 40 years, lives have been saved. Ecosystems have been restored. Communities have been revitalized. It's incredible to look back where we started and to realize how far we've all come. The things we've learned in the last 40 years must now be built into our vision for the next 40 years and beyond. That's one of the reasons why we're marking this milestone at the National Academies of Science today. As we reach the end of 40 years and stand on the precipice of our next 40 years, we must think about what kind of role the National Academies can play. And that's what I want to spend some time on today. The best scientific minds, both inside and outside this agency, have recognized that many of today's environmental challenges are subtler and more complex than in the past. They may not be as obvious as blazing rivers or smog, but they're every bit as urgent, whether it's global climate change, electronic waste, or environmental justice. Today's issues are broad in scope and widespread in their impacts. It's not clear that the strategies of the past are the best strategies for producing the necessary solutions. You see, historically, environmental protection has been shaped by questions. Questions like this: what is the maximum amount of pollution that can be emitted into the air without sacrificing regulatory compliance? I used to run an enforcement program, very important question to me. Another question: what is the highest level of toxicity that can be present in our products without breaking the law? How many people must fall ill before a standard needs to be strengthened? That's an important approach, though. because the old approach helped us make people understand how important our work was, helps us talk about our work in a way that the average American understands. It was essential for helping us assess and manage risk the way EPA has done successfully for nearly three decades. But as you can see, it focused on how environmentally abusive we can be under the constraints of regulations and how to develop regulations to try to make sure we were being protective. Today we have a new opportunity in front of us. We have an opportunity to focus on how environmentally protective and sustainable we can be. You see, it's the difference between treating disease and pursuing wellness. It's a difference, I believe, is fundamental to the future of our work at EPA. Environmental science of the last 40 years has propelled us to new levels of awareness. And we owe great thanks to every single scientist at EPA, at state government, here at the academies, who's contributed to that body of work. I see Kevin Teichman, too. I also have to say hi to him. We have a new understanding of what needs to be done and new tools to help us get there. Thanks to the work of bodies like the National Academies, we are better equipped to understand the vast connections between all of the issues we face and make the strong scientific case we need to take comprehensive actions. In the 21st century, our mission to protect human health and the environment requires that we understand these links, that we work across disciplines, that we do what it takes to address problems in their extraordinary complexity. But recognizing complexity is just the beginning. It is a first step in confronting our challenges in a sustainable way. EPA's got power. We're empowered with four decades of experience, a wealth of data, wonderful staff, innovative tools. The hard questions are we making the absolute most of these tools to accomplish our mission, our vital mission to protect human health and the environment? Are our methods keeping pace with the incredible advances we have seen? Are we keeping pace with the environmental threats of the modern world? On the eve of our 40th anniversary, I'm happy to join you in announcing a major step towards answering these questions and moving into the next phase of environmental protection. EPA and the National Academies are convening the best minds in the field to explore the topic of sustainability and determine how it can be systematically incorporated into every aspect of EPA's work. Every aspect. Sustainability is about understanding that environmental challenges do not obey bright lines, and they don't understand numeric limits. They are not constrained by disciplinary boundaries or the box walls of an organizational chart. It's about ensuring that we see the big picture and are not addressing one environmental issue only to create another consequence in the process. We've seen how easy it is to do the right things, but sometimes we learn that we did them in the wrong ways. In a sustainable approach, we will be able to support advances in renewable biofuels without negative impacts on food supplies or clean water. We can ensure that the development of catalytic converters or solar voltaic cells don't deplete rare and scarce minerals. We can disinfect our water without creating toxic and hazardous byproducts in the process. As you heard, this is not the first time EPA has been called to approach environmental protection through a new and unique lens. In 1983, the National Academies took the unprecedented step of convening the best scientific minds to codify the concept of risk into EPA's daily work. Out of that historic undertaking came, yes, the Red Book, which set the foundation, the very foundation, for so much of what we do at EPA. As then Administrator Bill Ruckelshaus said, that guidance would help achieve a better conceptual, statutory, and societal framework to cope with risk in our country. Well, today, we have to do more than cope. Risk assessment and management will always be essential components of our daily work, but our work must evolve along with our understanding of complexity and the recognition that sustainability is the next step forward. We're ready to build upon the reactive responses, banning and reducing, lessening and minimizing risk, while we work toward the proactive efforts, creation, innovation, synergy, and sustainability. So yes, today I am formally requesting President Cicerone and the National Academies convene a committee of experts to provide to the US EPA an operational framework for sustainability that applies across all of the agency's programs, policies, and actions. It is my hope that their guidance, which is already being called, ready, the Green Book, will be foundational to our work in the coming decades. I look forward to reviewing the panel's recommendations next summer. Building a framework for sustainability won't be easy. Nothing we do is easy. It will require the best thinking, knowledge, and insights available, and it will need to be evaluated and honed over time. The risk framework made enormous day-to-day impacts on the work of EPA, even as it was continually revised and refined. The sustainability framework has the potential to do the same. As the work of the NAS is reviewed and incorporated, it can have tremendous impact on the way we conduct our daily business. So to clarify, what I'm announcing today is not an initiative, it's not a program, it's not a project, it's a new approach. It's a step towards the most effective pursuit of all of our work, including our statutory requirements, by incorporating sustainability into our foundations at EPA. It's fitting that this bold step comes as we commemorate our past. As we remember four decades of incredible accomplishments, we find ourselves at a critical juncture. In the same way that science was the foundation for the 10 accomplishments I spoke of earlier, it will continue to be groundbreaking research and exploration that drives our efforts in the years ahead, including the 7 priorities I've outlined for EPA's future. It's an ambitious list of priorities: taking action on climate change, improving air quality, assuring the safety of chemicals, cleaning up our communities, protecting America's waters, expanding the conversation on environmentalism and working for environmental justice, building strong state and tribal partnerships. Each of these will be informed or advanced by scientific study and independent analysis, and each will benefit from a new approach to our mission. It's time to rise. Rise to the challenges of today, using the best of what we have to meet the needs of the current generation while strengthening the possibilities of future generations. The Green Book will be a foundation for this new approach, a critical step toward a healthier and more sustainable future. I look forward to working with all of you in the years and months ahead. Months more than years. And just because it is our 40th birthday, please allow me the luxury of asking all the EPA employees in the room to stand for a second so I can thank them in front of you for all their extraordinary work on this and so many other things. Thank you all very much.
Thank you, Administrator Jackson, for that context and that challenge. I now have the perfect person to respond to that challenge. It was the third person on this panel. Bernard Goldstein has been named to chair the committee that will study this and provide the report to EPA. He comes with perfect qualifications for this. He is currently a professor in the Department of Environmental and Occupational Health at the University of Pittsburgh Graduate School of Public Health. And as the administrator said, his background includes having been assistant administrator of EPA for R&D. I might add that aside from Dr. Goldstein, that we will be posting the names of the rest of the committee this week on our website at the current projects system on the left-hand menu. Please look that up at your first opportunity. Bernie?
Administrator Jackson, thank you. President Cicerone, I'm really honored and humbled and very challenged to be here. This is quite a task. It's quite an important task. You've heard about the importance. One thing I need to set straight from the very beginning is something that President Cicerone did not tell you about how the Academy goes about selecting committee members. Generally, the chair knows less than anybody else on the committee about the subject, not generally, but at least very often. And that's certainly true today. We have a distinguished committee. They've worked very hard in this area. They've got lots of ideas, and it's really going to be a pleasure to be the chair of a group that's going to be considering this important issue. I may not be the one most knowledgeable, but I think I'm the oldest member of the committee, so I'm going to fall back on that retreat of the aged, which is to talk about history. And it's been set up very well to talk about the Red Book, the risk paradigm book. It's sort of interesting and I think important to the committee that was now going to start to think back as to what happened there. First, it wasn't just something that came out of the blue. It wasn't just something that the committee invented. There was lots of work about risk before then. There was lots of thinking about how risk assessment and risk management were put together. The whole issue of how to go about doing it had been addressed by occupational medicine physicians dealing with folks who were made sick by chemicals. It had been addressed by the Food and Drug Administration and thinking about how to approve drugs. It had been addressed by EPA scientists. And a lot of the thinking was already in place when the Academy came and sort of put it together and conceptualized the approach in a way that became what we know today as the risk assessment paradigm. Similarly for our committee, there is an enormous amount of work that has been done, not just here in the United States, but worldwide. And in fact, I think, and President Cicerone and I were talking about this just before we started, the role of the Academy, the National Academy of Science of the United States, as stronger as it is now than it was then, still the rest of the world has caught up. And while in the past, basically this was the major game in town in terms of the globe, now there are lots of other areas which are working very hard in this kind of science, have made many contributions to sustainability, and will not necessarily follow the lead of where the U.S. National Academy of Sciences goes. And I think that means that we have to be very sensitive to the global activities in this area as we do try to meet this charge. Another major role of the 1983 Red Book was really a semantic role. It was to clear out that semantic underbrush which was in everybody's way. At the time, for instance, the way that hazard was identified by the Red Book was the hazard is an intrinsic property of a chemical or physical agent. Well, the British primarily define hazard as being what we call risk. Risk requires, under the U.S. National Academy definition, requires exposure. Well, why doesn't hazard acquire exposure and risk be the intrinsic property? There's nothing particular about the language that requires it to be one way or the other. It needed some degree of codification, so we could talk to each other. And the Academy did that superbly well in giving very clear definitions of what we meant by these terms. I don't have to tell you about sustainability. It's a wonderful term. We all support it. I very often with my students or talking to a public audience will talk about sustainability or sustainable development and say, okay, would anyone raise their hand here who's opposed to sustainability? Let's see, a show of hands. It's not a term it's in many ways too positive a term for us to really come to grips with. We're going to have to be able to come to grips with what we mean by sustainability if we're going to be able to be responsive to what Administrator Jackson has asked us to do. Do we think of sustainability as a process? Do we think of it as a product? Well, I'm not going to provide any answers. Obviously, that's the role of the committee. In fact, one of the more interesting aspects of this is to announce this process before the committee meets. Usually, the Academy only allows something to go public after the Academy has basically made its statement. I think it just shows the importance of the project, the importance of where we are at this particular time on this globe in terms of the challenges that Administrator Jackson has so eloquently put before us. One of the things about the Red Book is that it wasn't immediately accepted. It seems to be now in retrospect, but in fact, it took a while. It's a lot of pushback. I became an assistant administrator of EPA's research and development soon after the Red Book's report. I had nothing directly to do with the report, but we embraced it. And I remember I had a tagline at the end of just about every talk I gave from 1983 to 1985, which was 10 years from now, risk assessment is either going to be something that's regularly accepted as part of what we do, or it will be responded to by, oh, risk assessment. Oh, yeah, did we try that in the 80s? Failed miserably. And the same thing, it wasn't just the Academy report. It was all the work done by people at EPA, by people in the entire global community looking at these issues that built upon it and put it into something that we use relatively routinely today. We hope, Paul, you can use that line, but we hope you won't need it. When we think about what we're going to do, it's true, we have a very short time frame. We need to be responsive very quickly. We're going to need lots of help. The way that the committee will work is on December 14th and 15th. There will be a meeting at the Academy, a workshop with lots of presenters. We hope you can all attend. We hope you can all add your voices. There will be an opportunity on the website, which is being developed as we speak, for people to tell us what they think, to give us good references, to let us know what work they think is really accomplishing the goals and what isn't. So we hope you will participate and join with us in trying to deal with this. And then in February, we're going to go to Southern California and spend a week working in closed session and to come out with a document. I started off by talking about an Academy secret. There's another Academy process. President Cicerone mentioned it, but I want to make sure that we understand it. The committees get credit for what they do, and this is the 13th Academy Committee I've chaired of one form or another. But a lot of the credit, perhaps as much or more than the committee deserves, goes to the review process. That review process, I've got scars I can show you. That review process is intense. It will need to be intense. It will need to be shoved back into the committee's face. Are you being really responsive to the questions that have been raised? Are you doing things in a way that will make operationalize the goals of EPA? Will the framework really work? Will it provide the opportunity, as the risk framework has done, to be able to adapt, to be flexible enough to grow for the future challenges? That's the kind of feedback that we expect to get, and that will be a major part of whatever success comes out of what we hope will develop by this summer, 2011. Let me thank you again in advance for all that you are all going to contribute to the work of this committee, and thank you for allowing me to participate.
Thank you very much. So now you know the tapestry. We have 15 minutes for questions if you'd like to pose them. I think that Paul's going to take the administrator's place in the panel. And let me just say, because we are recording this, it would be best if you used the microphone, which is just about 8 rows back. If you don't use the microphone, you have the peril that the panelist is going to rephrase your question. So who would like to pose a question? Yes.
I've got a few. I'm Ira Feldman, Green Track Strategies, former special counsel at EPA headquarters, and I wear many sustainability hats. I think this is a very important day, one that I've been waiting for a long time, for EPA to embrace sustainability. I guess my question to anyone who might be able to address it is, what has led to the decision to have the National Academies embark upon a process that covers all EPA programs as opposed to ORD, Office of Research and Development, given the science and technology orientation of the National Academies, existing roundtable, and presumably the committee, but I don't want to presume, but we don't have the list of people on the committee yet. Similarly, as if you could just elaborate a little bit more on the process that you articulated. I heard about the workshop in December and then a closed session in February. Are there other meetings? Are they also closed? The National Academy, unfortunately, does not have a great track record of having open meetings to other experts in the field, and it would be nice to see a different process come about for that. And as related to that, buy-in from other sustainability groups and initiatives in the United States who might have complementary expertise and lots of it to offer to the existing roundtable. Thank you.
I'll begin with at least the first part of your question. One of the things that the administrator referred to in her remarks was this new level of awareness that we're bringing to the challenges that we're facing. And perhaps no one said it better than Einstein when he talked about how problems cannot be solved at the same level of awareness that created them. What we're talking about is that when we look at the foundations of EPA, one of the things that you'll hear in an unwavering voice is that all of our decisions, all of our actions need to be based in sound science, the best science, with the highest degree of scientific integrity. So it actually isn't unusual that when we turn to that new level of awareness and look at the sustainability approach, the sustainability framework, that the construct for that sustainability framework is in the body of work that's been referenced over the past 20 years of sustainability science. So I think that's because the work of the agency is based in science. As we proceed across the work and all aspects of what EPA does, sustainability and science will be going hand in hand.
As far as the process?
In terms of the process, as I say, I hope that everybody would be willing to contribute what they know to the committee's process. There is that workshop December 14th and 15th that's open. Please, if you have ideas, if there's something you'd like to communicate, we're very happy to receive it, and I'm sure the committee will take it into account.
Questions? Steve Cook with the BNA Daily Environment Report. Could you give me a brief definition of what sustainability is? I mean, one might think that EPA is and has been in the sustainability business for 40 years. So just what exactly are you talking about here?
No, I'd be happy to address that because I think that one of the important points is to recognize what we know and what we don't know and why we're here together with the National Academies. The body of work over the past 20 plus years has often relied on the definition of meeting the needs of the current generation while preserving the ability of future generations to meet their needs. And this is an important foundational statement about what we intend for sustainability. But I think it's also important to focus on what Dr. Goldstein said in his remarks, that it's important to get clarity of definitions. It's important to get clarity of concepts and the key elements and the foundational pillars of sustainability, and that's what we're really turning to the NAS to do as it constructs this operational framework for EPA's consideration.
Let me try to do this as an individual, because I think it's an important question, and not as a committee, because the committee is going to have to look at that very clearly. I very much liked what the administrator said about it's not just treating illness, it's preventing it. That's where I come from as a public health person. To me, risk assessment, which I feel very strongly about it being very valuable, risk assessment really depends upon having a risk to assess. I know I can measure the levels of benzene in this room and tell you what your risk of leukemia is for the hour you may spend here. Primary prevention is preventing this from happening in the first place, preventing the benzenes from coming out, preventing cigarette smoking to occur. It's not just treating it once it's there. So what I heard was the administrator saying sustainability to her is primary prevention, not secondary prevention. To me, risk assessment is secondary prevention. We need primary prevention now.
I'd like to add a word, if I may, Rich. Paul Anastas just gave the definition of sustainability, which was preferred by former Prime Minister of Norway, Gro Harlem Brundtland, I think 1987, and nobody has ever said it better. Mm-hmm. That's exactly how I would have responded. But to be operational, there has to be even more specification. So, for example, what are the needs of the current generation that have to be met and the presumed needs of future generations, which should be, the option should not be reduced? Well, the needs are more than just food, clothing, and shelter. They go more broadly into things like education and employment. Now, they're probably as broad as EPA's responsibilities are. They don't necessarily have to cover all of those other perceived needs. So the committee and certainly the agency are going to have to make more specific judgments as the whole task gets more focused, obviously. And then how many generations? There are different cultural and historical expectations of how much responsibility our generation has for our children, for our grandchildren. Is it seven generations? And these will eventually become issues for practical decisions, programmatic and other kinds of authority decisions in EPA. How long should we be aiming for something to be sustainable, a practice or a process or resources?
Yes. Sure, it would help, I think.
My name is Mike Weinstein. I'm the director of the PSEG Institute for Sustainability Studies at Montclair University in New Jersey. I'd like to follow up on both those questions because I was also concerned about what I perceive with lack of knowledge of what's in the Red Book, a narrowness of vision. I can say that the Brundtland definition has been accused of being unabashedly anthropocentric by people like Enrique Leff and Andrew Dobson. That's, you know, we can have that debate separately. But one constant definition coming from our common journey, or at least the authors, Bill Clark and Robert Cates, is the interaction of humans and their environment and the ability of humans to keep those interactions moving along sustainable trajectories. That's one other working definition. I agree, if you ask everyone in this room what the definition of sustainability is, you can get that many definitions. But the one point I'd like to make is I'm hoping that this will really use sustainability science as not only our common journey has discussed it, but the very current Early House report that just came out. The idea being it's not just risk analysis, but it can all be risk analysis, but shouldn't the EPA, the Environmental Protection Agency, be dealing with things like the fact that we're using, you know, ecosystem goods and services faster than they can be replaced and perhaps the attendant risks of that? Just one more example and I'll shut up. You know, it's one thing to talk about risk, but it's another thing to talk about risk in complex systems where you've got to identify thresholds and tipping points, and especially those kinds of tipping points. And I just read an example coming down today. If a single wire burns out somewhere in a Boeing 777, the cascading effects of that risk can bring this highly complex system to the ground in the crash. And we need to be searching for those kinds of risks. So how I hope that the committee will early say what it is they're tending to take on so the rest of the science community can comment in that context of what the rest of us deal with when we say we're dealing with sustainability science.
I guess I'd just make a remark or two, because I think your comments were important. When we're looking at sustainability, it's often thought that sustainability, because it has so many dimensions, is often discussed as being ill-defined or nebulous. And I disagree with that characterization. I'd say that it's complex. And the complexity that you cite it's tremendous, makes a tremendous challenge, but it also speaks directly to why it's so necessary. The challenges that we're confronting, whether it's as EPA or anybody involved in the protection of human health and the environment, needs to understand and address this complexity, because in the absence of that, we will continue looking at problems one by one in a rather fragmented and reductionist way. And we need to complement those traditional approaches, as represented by the risk paradigm, with this integrative understanding across complex systems. So is it an easy task? Far from it. It's just, I think, an imperative task if we're going to take on the challenges that we're facing.
Okay. Yes. Yes, sir.
I'm David Mogg, retired recently as a science teacher at Sidwell Friends School. My question is, the best science technology can't work if we don't have public understanding and public support for our efforts. Is the mandate of this committee broad enough to look at the educational, the public understanding component, and maybe even the education of Congress?
Not as I read, I couldn't agree with you more, but not as I read the mandate of the committee. But I think you could easily, and I don't want to speak for the committee, say, well, if you're going to operationalize sustainability, education might be a very strong part of it. But your point is an excellent one.
Well, certainly an excellent point. Going back to the example of a single wire in a Boeing aircraft, however, certainly we, represented through this committee, can add value in helping to design a system that won't depend on one wire, and also a protocol for examination and maintenance of systems that are so vulnerable. So there's a lot to be done. On the educational front, I think children can actually lead the way, but I'm not sure that this particular study is our best way to add to that task.
And again, just adding a point on the one wire example, that it is so important that we understand the foundations of sustainability.
That's right.
And
that's right.
one of the foundations, as we look at the greatest sustainable system that we could ever have as a teacher, which is natural ecosystems, that would have to think that at least one foundational pillar is resilience. And understanding the components, the lessons of resilience, mm-hmm. mean that you're not going to depend on that one wire, because you're with sustainability as a goal and nature as one of our best teachers, then we will hopefully avoid that type of thinking.
Mm-hmm. Well, good. I want to thank all of you for coming out today. Just a few points as we close. First of all, I hope that this betrays your interest in the sustainability and its role at EPA, and that you will stay involved with this study. We will have ways for you to comment, to make suggestions, to provide inputs. And as I said before, please track this week the committee makeup and some of the outline of the work, and we will have a website for you to provide input, certainly at a very early stage. Second is, I hope you'll stay for libations at the back of the museum and a chance to see friends and professional colleagues. So thank you for coming out, and I hope you'll thank the panel for their presentations.
This initiative